This is the Disaster Recovery Hour. Here's your host, Chris Plunkett.
Good morning. It's Saturday. This is the AM 970 The Apple Talking New York. I'm Chris Plunkett, your host of Disaster Recovery Hour. Every Saturday, another week gone by. It seems like it was just yesterday I did another show. The show is, if you haven't heard of us before, you haven't gone to the website or the Twitter page, what we talk about emergencies and disasters and how we can prevent further damage after these things do happen and try to stick you in the right direction. Having the tools and the tricks of the trade to mitigate further damage is something the first responders are always, the fire departments, police departments, OEM departments, which are Office of Emergency Management, whether it's the Port Authority, whether it's New Jersey, the state of New York, they're always putting out information on how to... again, to mitigate in the world of losses and damages. In the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about Haiti, and originally started a couple of months ago when I had Daniel Andre from the Haitian Civic Organization of Paterson, New Jersey, and he is the president of that organization. And after the earthquake hit, he was collaborating with some other nonprofits in the area and trying to get relief aid down there, whether it was dollars or supplies or manpower. Down to the Haitian community with that devastating earthquake. So what happened from there was a couple of weeks later, I was contacted by a couple of guys who had gone down to Haiti and have been doing some fabulous work down there. It's Paul Sebring and Paul Wagner, Little Paul and Big Paul. They were in last month's Men's Journal. It's called the Haitian EMT Cowboys. It was a heck of an article. And these guys reached out for us because we were communicating through the Twitter. We also had another one. We had Tim Falconer. He was from Wave Place, and he's about one laptop per child. Now he just went back down there to Haiti, and so we're continuing with that. Not so much a theme as much as it's so relevant here. And now they're coming down. We're going to have this this Thomas is coming down the pike for them. This hurricane, and they're still living in tents. There's always a million people displaced. If you had heard the podcast from before or the show. With some of the things that Little Paul and Big Paul were experiencing down there, it's just there's no rudimentary EMTs or 911 services, and I've had people ask me through the comments page and face to face of why Haiti, but you know what, Haiti's our neighbor, they're close by, and in this world of technology, it's a very small world, so helping your fellow, humanitarian type of needs is it's relative. It's you just can't be isolated. No man's an island, I guess. I'm not going to go political or anything, but I have two guests that are also affiliated and doing work with the information and getting it out there on the out on the web and producing some films. My first is Katie McKenna. She's a web producer for InsideDisaster.com and also Nicholas Gillette. He's a film director and a blogger and part of Disaster.com. Thanks for being here today. Appreciate it.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having us on.
Nick, I'm going to start with you. Why don't you give me a little background on how you got into this type of business and also how you got into the Haiti situation?
Well, I always have been traveling and shooting films and stills in the third world. And PTV in Canada, they put an ad. They were looking for a web producer, someone that could go into the next disaster and blog and film and produce mini docs or mini stories for the web. So I entered the ad, and that was last September. We didn't know where we would go. We could be sent anywhere. I would be working along the crew that was filming for the TV show, and we waited until January, and we found ourselves in Haiti.
So when you got down into Haiti, I know from the other guests, some of that horrific sights that they saw. What were some of the things that stuck out for you? I mean, because you need to be pretty much removed from kind of helping because you need to document. That's basically your role at this point, right?
Yes, that's the thing. You're not here to save lives. You're here to document. And you find yourself in this apocalypse, if you will. I mean, this was the town that collapsed. We got in right away. We were there on the second day. And we had to focus just on our job. But
that must be, go on, I'm sorry.
The stories have to go out. the outside world had to know what the situation was.
Right. Now,
even though I was working only with the camera and I wasn't a doctor or a rescue worker, we were still useful in a way. That's why I was trying to portray really the stories of the people, what their situation was and things like that, just to raise awareness outside. So we were bringing help in a way.
Right. Now, Katie, how did you get involved with that?
Well, this is, you know, my background is in documentary film, and I started getting really interested in the web as a way to kind of use the same skills to tell stories about what's happening in the world. Right before I got involved in this project, I did my master's degree, and I was doing a bunch of work in humanitarian studies and looking at the kind of complexities and challenges that can come up from these huge humanitarian operations that are happening around the world all the time now. You know, the funding for humanitarian operations has doubled in the past 10 years, and this trend is not going anywhere, you know. So there's a lot of questions to ask about, you know, how these things are unfolding and how we can do better. And that was something I was really interested in. So when Andrea, the producer of Inside Disaster, this documentary series, approached me and said, you know, we've made a deal with the Red Cross. We're going to be following them into the next big disaster that they respond to. And we're going to build a big educational website around some of the themes that are going to come out of this film series. Do you want to be involved? You know, it was an absolute no-brainer for me. It was right up my alley.
So, Andrea got a hold of you. So it was just a matter of, you know, because like we all say with almost nowadays with this terrorist threats all the time, it's not if it's going to happen, so just when it's going to happen. So prior to that, the Red Cross contacting you guys, how long was the downtime before something actually happened?
Oh, I think the team was, they were kind of ready and waiting in place from about September 2009 on. So I brought Nico onto the team, and I think it was late September, early October. And then we were waiting. We were waiting. You know, it's a horrible thing to say, but you're sitting there watching these disaster reports and thinking, what's going to be the next big one?
Right.
And when this happened in Haiti, they knew within about 2 hours that this was it. Mm. And the crew just turned around and deployed. So Nico traveled down there with the whole documentary film crew. There was five of them. But once he got down there, his job was actually quite different than theirs. You know, we launched our website, InsideDisaster.com, the same day as the earthquake, and we wanted to have reports coming from the field. So, but even though the documentary film crew, what their job was to mainly focus on the Red Cross relief effort, and they were working with the Red Cross team. Another set of them was, you know, trying to find stories of survivors who were, you know, trying to make it in those first days after the earthquake. Nico's job, what I told him was, it was a really simple mandate. I said, Nico, just go out to those camps, to the millions of people who haven't had any humanitarian aid, and tell me how people are surviving. So that was his job, you know, and he was traveling almost completely on his own with a satellite modem, a laptop, a camera, and his sound gear, and going in, and every day was, you know, recording stories, talking to people, taking photos. And, yeah, doing that under pretty stressful, extreme circumstances for a month straight.
That's difficult for Nico. I'm sure it's very difficult to just film and not help out at all. It must have been kind of tearing you apart at that point, no?
Yes, at the beginning, but then you understand how important your job is. At the beginning, people really wanted to tell their stories. They wanted to send messages to the outside world. So as the days go by, you just play your role. Yeah.
If you just joined us, this is the Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host, Chris Plunkett. My guest today is Nicholas Jolette and Katie McKenna. They're documentary film web producers. Katie, what's the website?
InsideDisaster.com is the educational website, and Inside the Haiti Earthquake is the first-person simulation. So InsideTheHaitiEarthquake.com is the second one.
Okay. All right. We're going to go to a break, pay some bills, and be right back.
You're listening to the Disaster Recovery Hour with your host, Chris Plunkett, on AM 970, The Apple. And now back to the Disaster Recovery Hour on AM 970, The Apple. Here's your host, Chris Plunkett.
And we're back. You're listening to AM 970, The Apple, talking New York. This is Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host, Chris Plunkett, every Saturday morning. We're talking about the more people reaching out and trying to do the right thing down in Haiti because God knows they needed the, you know, it's how many months now? It's almost 10 months later. And now they are going to be contending with a hurricane. So, Katie, with the Red Cross, when they gave you your marching orders and you went about your business, is there a kind of an editing thing, or they're in control of it, or you're just reporting? Or I should say, Nico's reporting, and then you're producing the reports for them to view, or is it just coming out?
Yeah, there's no more marching orders from the Red Cross. You know, the film's director and producer, Nadine Pekaneza, she got in touch with the Red Cross about a year before the earthquake happened and started speaking to them about the idea of doing a film that would follow them through the next big disaster recovery operation. So, you know, with all documentaries, you need independence. It's all about being independent. So the Red Cross, you know, they agree to the access. But, of course, it's a risk for them. You know, they open their doors. It's not for them to editorialize, and they don't have approval over what goes in there. They see the content to make sure that it's factually correct. But at the end of the day, you know, it's the film is going to show what really happened. And, you know, one of the things that we always say is that these guys in some ways are their own worst critics. They are the ones who, they're living through these operations. They see when the mistakes happen. And when the mistakes happen, it really affects people's lives down there. So they want to do better and they want to learn. So it's not a question of them trying to censor anything or, you know, hide any of the critical bad stuff that happened down there.
Now, Nico, when I was with my past guest, Little Paul and Big Paul, they had, you know, traveling through the countryside and trying to help out and do the right thing, because there were so many hospitals that some hospitals had certain equipment and they didn't have certain equipment, so they had to transport patients to the other side. Now, in your travels, was it were you hiring someone to drive you? I mean, how'd you get around the countryside?
I found two young guys on the street that had lost their house and parents, and we kind of became friends, and I hired them as my fixers, if you will. They knew the streets and the place very well. And I found a driver, a guy with an old car. And with my two friends, we would just cruise around. We didn't always find gasoline, but when we did, we would travel around. My two guides knew, being survivors themselves, they knew where there was camps that never had any help, where there was empty camps, where the slums were, where it was dangerous, where it was not, and so on.
One of the unfortunate byproducts of those camps where the people were trying to, you know, doing cooking and fuel and things like that, they were actually, there was mishaps, and they were torching at any given time. They could torch 15 to 20 little tents all in a row. And then, so they were talking about how many burn victims they were contending with. Forget about the people that were crushed or lost limbs. That was an unfortunate situation from there. So that's, you know, and that goes back to, okay, what, is there any type of plan in place if a disaster does happen? And I believe that it should be more on the government side. There should be some form of preparedness and drilling. But they didn't really have a proper EMT situation or 911 down there, per the information I received. So what were the, Nico, what was some of the things that you were traveling the countryside, you were filming, you were documenting, some of the things that were anything applicable that you've seen in your life before this earthquake?
Yeah, I traveled a lot before, and I lived 8 years in St. Lucia, and they are Creole people, so I could understand the Haitian Creole quite a bit, and I could understand the culture, and this allowed me to really be with the people and understand their way of thinking, how they were coping, and so I could really do stories where they would tell how they felt in their own words, their own views. Are they expected the help to come, or it should be delivered, but it shouldn't be through the government. It should be given directly and things like that.
Now, I went on the website, InsideDisaster.com, and I saw that simulation of three categories. There's the relief worker, there's the survivors, and what was the other category?
The journalist.
And the journalist. You should definitely check that out. It's not a game by no means, but it's interactive and it's very eye opening. Now, those kinds of things that since you're independent, are any of the larger news agencies were interested in grabbing some of your footage, Nico?
Yes, once in a while, the news agencies were looking for more dramatic, big stories, and I did a few like that. Like, you know, they were looking for looters and food distributions going bad. So a few networks in Canada picked a few of that. But most of my work was done in the camp, just one-on-one stories, everyday stories. You know, where do you find water? Where do you find food? What are the options? Should you stay in camp and wait for help? Should you move somewhere else to have more chances of finding help workers and things like that?
Now, Nico, were you sending that information back on a daily basis to Katie, or was it after a couple of days and then Katie, you had that work?
That was the exhausting part, is that I would shoot all day and then at night I would edit and write and upload the almost finished stories by midnight, 2 in the morning. I would upload with my satellite modem. So it was every day.
So, Katie, you waited at that time for it, or did you wait till the morning so you can get some rest because you know you're going to put in some hours editing and doing your thing?
You know, I didn't go through anything close to what Nico went through, but I did go through my own little version of hell here, kind of being awake what seemed like 24 hours a day. Because, yeah, I wanted to be online when Nico was online. Those satellite modems are expensive and difficult to get working. So if I had a chance to, you know, Skype chat with him and get the videos, I wanted to make it happen. So yeah, there was a lot of late nights and long days because, you know, as I'm sure all your other guests on the show have felt, when you have those stories, there's a real urgency to want to get them out. So Nico would deliver that stuff and then we'd spend all the next day kind of, you know, trying to get them out through the web and also through the different news networks.
What kind of news networks, if you don't mind?
We were on, you know, all the major Canadian news networks use Nico's stuff, and we got interest from the U.S. as well, but it's like the truth is, you know, Nico would send back some kind of incredible, like, 2.5-minute story about, like, the difficulties of these food lines and how they work, and then you see the news that night, and what they had used was, like, a 5-second clip of somebody being trampled. You know, just the most violent, disturbing, kind of horrible shot was all they were looking for, not the kind of deep stories of what was really going on. And that is really kind of what we're trying to capture by creating this website and simulation. Like, if your users want to check out InsideTheHaitiEarthquake.com, what we've created there is a real-life simulation of what happened in Haiti. So you can choose to play, you know, to go through this simulation from the point of view of a journalist, a survivor, or an aid worker. And all the footage is real footage that was shot in Haiti. Like, you'll see that footage that I just described, that person being trampled when Nico is shooting in the food lines. And, I mean, the idea behind this simulation is, like, it's an old-fashioned one, but it's an important one, which is just walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. If you want to go down to Haiti as an aid worker, if you've decided you want to go down and help, or even if you're just a donor, you know, somebody who gave money and is trying to figure out, well, why has the relief operation been so slow down there? Why isn't there more going on? This is a chance for you to see for yourself what goes on down there. And a lot of the people who have tried it so far, you know, I think they gravitate towards going to playing the journalist or being the aid worker. You know, they have this idea of, I'll be good at that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a game, and you don't get a score. What you get is an experience. You make these decisions, and you feel the consequences of them. And the truth is, what I'd really encourage to people who really want to understand what's going on down there is to try the role of the survivor. If you want to go down to Haiti and help people, you know, see what it's like to go apply for a job after your house has collapsed and have somebody tell you that you need an address and a cell phone number to get a job. You know, that's the kind of frustrations that people are facing down there. Well, I don't have an address. My house has collapsed.
Right.
And this kind of thing. So this is the kind of thing, this kind of detail is what you're going to see inside these simulations. So I really hope people get the chance to go check it out at InsideTheHaitiEarthquake.com.
We're going to go to a break in a few seconds. This is Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host, Chris Plunkett. I'm with Katie McKenna and Nico. I like Nico. That's nice and quick and to the point. That's the kind of guy who's in the field, the kind of guy you trust in the field, that's for sure. When we come back from the break, guys, I want to talk about, you know, where's the funding coming from and the frustrations with funding. Again, this is a Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host, Chris Plunkett, every Saturday at 7 a.m. We're going to go to a break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Disaster Recovery Hour with your host, Chris Plunkett, on AM 970, The Apple. And now back to the Disaster Recovery Hour on AM 970, The Apple. Here's your host, Chris Plunkett.
And we're back. It's Disaster Recovery Hour. Chris Plunkett, and I'm your host, AM 970, The Apple, talking New York. Again, our subject today is continuing with our the unfortunate situation in Haiti. Nico, why don't you give us, I'm sure you have 1,000 stories, when you close your eyes, I'm sure you see those stories as if they just happened a couple of seconds ago. Why don't you give me one of your experiences that kind of have left a footprint on you, if you will?
There was many. In the early days, in the first morning I went downtown, I found myself in front of a field of dead bodies. People were just dropping their bodies there in the sun, and I was there with a friend I had met the night before. He was a Haitian that came back from Dominican Republic, and we were trying to find his parents to see if they were still alive. And as we came down to that field of bodies, he panicked, and we had to leave fast to go find his parents. But as I was there snapping pictures, I snapped pictures of girls that were on the sidewalk that were still alive.
Yeah, that's.
And as we were taken in the moment, I just left and I just forgot about these girls. And as I was checking my pictures later on, I just saw these pictures of these girls that were still alive. So you were asking me how hard it was not to help people but just be a journalist. So this is an example. I would have regrets after thinking that I could have helped them back then, but I didn't. I was just in the chaos and on the move.
That's amazing, Nico.
Then the best. There was also great things. Early on at night, I would hear people sing, and I asked my friends what they were doing at night, because it was strange to see a Caribbean city with no power, with no pumping music at night, but people would just sing in the camps. And I went one night in a camp, and all people just gather in circles and just sing all night, praying, asking for things to get better and for the earthquake never to come back. And that was beautiful.
As human beings, or you gather, and I guess that's the most important thing, not things and items and things that you possess. So, Nico, what do you grab out of this disaster? What are the things? There are things that could have been prevented, or you see anything moving in a positive direction from your own experience, your own opinion?
It's that same old idea of having a good hospitals and good buildings and things built well before a disaster strikes. Basically, if a country was rich, people would die less than a poor country. And now, as far as how you bring help in, that really depends on the case. And for Haiti, it was amazingly chaotic because it was the downtown and the port that collapsed. And there was nothing in place. To my point of view, I thought I saw more soldiers than help workers. That would be my take, that we should trust the people more. It's not going to go into chaos right away. Bring the help first. Prioritize the airport for the aid planes. Right. Security is not that important. What happens, actually, when I came back, Port-au-Prince became dangerous 6 months after. But right after the disaster, when there is no police, no government, nothing in place, it's not really anarchy. People are in shock. People help each other. There was no crazy riots. I can say I almost felt safe safer than if it was not a disaster zone. You know what I mean?
Yes, I know. I understand. I understand. Well, Nico, I'm thankful that you came on the program. I know you're busy. You got to cut loose, and I'll. Katie, we'll pick up some of the things. I got some questions for you still.
Great.
And Nico, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Again, if you just joined us, it's Ask Recovery Hour. I'm Chris Plunkett, your host. Topic is we're talking about, still about Haiti. It's been ongoing for a couple of weeks, and let's hope that the damage that's going to be coming down the pike for them is not as severe. Katie, so grabbing all this information and staying up late at night and getting this information out. What were some of the things that that you took away from it?
I think the biggest thing that I took away from this is that, you know, we've got to get better at these things. We can't keep making the same mistakes in these operations when people's lives are at stake. And, you know, the stakes couldn't be higher. So that's what this website and the simulation are all about, are really to kind of give people the tools to understand what are the big issues that are going on the ground when these operations start unfolding. And, you know, so if you're going to go down there yourself, how can you make sure that you do a good job and you don't end up doing more harm than good? If you want to give money, how can you be an effective donor? Like, one of the things we have on our website is a donations hall of shame. And, you know, there's all these stories about after the tsunami in 2001, like everybody's trying to help, right? But some of the ways that they choose to help end up being kind of misguided. Like, there was these stories of the airport being blocked because planes are coming in with shipments of shoes. You know, these huge piles of shoes that were like high-heeled shoes, mismatched shoes, and they would just end up in a huge pile where nobody had time to sort through them and make them into pairs and figure out who could fit what.
Right.
You know, and if you want to donate, then find out what people really need down there. Don't clean out your garage. You know, this is the kind of tips that we're trying to help people think through and understand when they're trying to figure out how they can help. Because, I mean, that is really the amazing thing about these big disasters, is how much people do want to help. So we want to help to give them the tools to make sure that they do so in a really effective way.
Yeah, you know, Big Paul and Little Paul, the guys down in the Haitian Cowboys, EMT Cowboys, they were talking about there's thousands of aid workers down there from around the world who just drop whatever they're doing in their lives and went down there. And Paul was talking about one story about he had a warehouse full of medical supplies, and they were just, when they came off the planes, they were brought in, but no one had any logistical experience on what to do with them and how to separate them so they can, you know, obviously it's a triage. The whole country's in triage, right?
Yeah.
So he took 3 days just to get this warehouse in order and separate all the different, you know, the pain meds, the antibiotics, the syringes, yada, 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 because the turnaround time to look for something, a doctor would say, I need this. And it was an Easter egg hunt in the warehouse, mm-hmm, looking mm-hmm. for the stuff. So, which is exactly like the shoes, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, it's a good thing, but it's really not it's not constructive.
Well, it's one of the big, big issues that are facing anyone who works in disaster response right now, which is that nobody officially is in charge. So right now, you know, there's thousands of NGOs in Haiti, which means there's tens of thousands of relief workers down there. And yeah, sometimes people are doing, two NGOs are doing the exact same thing directly next to each other and kind of almost working in competition. But what's the alternative? You know, the UN does provide what they call the cluster system, where they invite NGOs to come in and coordinate and share information, but it's completely voluntary. So it's an open question. I don't know whether it would be better if there was one big kind of dictatorship structure telling everyone what to do. It might be more effective, but in some ways, the chaos that happens down there allows, you know, like the guys from MNA to go in and just fill gaps, right? They right. identified those gaps and they filled them, and that's a good thing too. Like, we need that. But yeah, I mean, the MO of most of these operations is kind of chaos, and that's definitely a problem that a lot of humanitarians are struggling with right now.
Do you see any other, you know, let's talk about Katrina. Was it, you see any parallels there?
I think, I mean, there's parallels in that months and months later, the recovery is not anywhere close to where it should be. In the case of Katrina, it's years later.
Right.
And then the question comes up, so who is accountable? You know, who's to blame and who do you ask? to be in charge in that situation? You know, I think it's easier to find answers to that question in the U.S. In Haiti, where the government is extremely weak, where there's a lot of NGOs that are doing their own thing, it's really hard to figure out who, not necessarily who's to blame, but who's, you know, who's got the answers for why this thing has been going so slowly. It's very, very complex down there. But at the same time, I think the more time that people spend really kind of getting to see how strong and resourceful and kind of resilient the Haitian people really are, the more hope you actually do end up having for the country. Not because they're going to be saved by, you know, international NGOs coming in, but because they actually, they've been doing it for themselves for, you know, decades and decades without any help from the outside, and that's probably what's going to help them pull through this in the end. They've got to figure out their own structures and their own ways to get through it.
Yeah, that's what the Pauls were saying a couple of weeks ago about how resilient they were. We're going to go to a break right now. Like I always say, we're going to pay some bills and be right back. Thanks.
You're listening to the Disaster Recovery Hour with your host, Chris Plunkett, on AM 970, The Apple. When disaster comes into your life and attacks your property, you need answers. CPP is the answer. CPP is a full-service emergency services and restoration company with 20 years' experience in emergency management and restoration. Our seasoned team of skilled professionals is ready to assess damages and restore your property to its pre-loss condition. Who do I call first? What about insurance? Is it safe to stay here? What do I do next? Fire, smoke, water, or mold? CPP restores your property and your peace of mind. CPP Emergency Services and Restoration. We've got answers. For more information, visit us on the web at www.cppems.com or give us a call at 201-483-8953. That's 201-483-8953. CPP Emergency Services and Restoration, servicing the New York Metro and Tri-State area. And now back to the Disaster Recovery Hour on AM 970, The Apple. Here's your host, Chris Plunkett.
And we're back. Again, it's the AM 970, The Apple, talking New York. Every Saturday morning, the Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host, Chris Plunkett. I usually say something if you just joined us, you're late, so I'll punish you later on. Katie, now, you were talking about the Red Cross saying, listen, the next disaster, I know you were working, assisting, or but when you actually hit the ground and Nico hit the ground and your other film teams hit the ground, did you guys have funding in place?
Yeah, the funding, so there's separate funding for the documentary series, which follows the Red Cross response in Haiti, and the website and interactive simulation that Nico and I worked on together with a whole team of about 20 people. So we applied for funding for that separately. And the way it works here in Canada, where we're based, is that a lot of funding for this kind of arts and multimedia production comes from public agencies. So yeah, we had money from different government agencies that supported our work, and everything was in place by the time they went down there.
So how does someone back here you know, in North America, they're handling that, and Nico and Team 1 or Team 2 or Team 5, they say, listen, we're going to need X amount of whatever. Whether it's housing or what Nico was talking about, you know, hiring a couple of guys from the streets, which is how it seems to work out best down there during a time of a crisis like that. You know, you want some guy off the street, right? You know, what better way to catch a thief than to hire a thief? So, but when it comes to that, who was the coordinator on the dollar side on your end for expediting that?
There's a few different people in charge of that. You know, that was all part of the planning before they went down. The truth is, yeah, they go down with envelopes of cash, basically, because there's no ATMs down there, and it's very difficult to even wire money down in those first few days after the quake. So, yeah, you have a budget. It's part of the plan. We had money in place. You know, when we were making the budget, we didn't know where the disaster was going to be, so you are guessing all the time. And Haiti's expensive. You know, it's one of the surprising things. I don't know if people realize, but, you know, gas is very rare. It's very expensive. Finding, you know, what Nico was describing, a good fixer, somebody who, you know, speaks two or three languages, who knows the city, who you can trust, who's got a good driver, that costs money. And we had coordinated that. We had planned for it beforehand, and by the time the team went down there, they had money in their pocket, and they knew roughly how much they were supposed to be spending every day.
Did they go into the Dominican, or did they went right into Haiti?
They flew into the Dominican, okay, and then drove across the border with the Red Cross.
Okay, so they got through with the Red Cross, because I know some of the other guys, it was a little difficult getting in. You know, go to the DR and then try to get over the border. And it's the ironic thing is, you know, these people here to help, and yet there was some resistance. Not some, there was a lot of resistance regarding moving throughout the country. You know, when all said and done, they're down there to help.
What we're trying to get people to realize is, like, wanting to help is a complicated thing. Wanting to help and helping are two different things, right? And, you know, there are cases. It's definitely not the case with your guests and the guys you were describing, but there are people who go down and they want to help, and they're completely unprepared for what they're going to actually run into down there. And that's something you're going to see if you try out this simulation that we created at Inside the Haiti Earthquake .com. You know, it's like sometimes there is a case where you think you want to help, you think you want to be a part of it, and you get down there and you don't have a place to stay, you don't have the money that you need, and you end up getting sick. And in that way, you can become kind of a burden on the same system that you're trying to bolster.
Right.
Kind of a downer of a message, but it's just that we want people to really, you know, ask themselves these hard questions before they go into these situations so that they can be prepared and so that they can really help people when they get there.
Right. I mean, almost becoming collateral damage on that end.
In some ways. And right, it's something that happens surprisingly often. You know, all these, the old school humanitarians, they all tell stories about people who show up down there. And, you know, one of the things we have on the site is a quiz for people who think they want to become humanitarian aid workers. And, you know, it asks you a bunch of questions about how many languages you speak, how much you've traveled, what kind of skills you have. But one of the questions that it also asks is, what are you running away from?
Oh, yeah, right.
This is something that happens, you know, kind of surprisingly often with people who end up going into this kind of work, is that they're kind of trying to escape from some situation at home that they don't want to deal with. And the Red Cross is really blunt about that. When they're interviewing people, they often ask people that question. And so we put it in our quiz as well. And, it just helps people to kind of think that stuff through before they get into the situation themselves.
So with the website and the simulation, and it's a couple minutes on either all three facets there. Out of those three things, what hit home for you? What was the most impact?
Oh, I'm just, you know, I'm so proud of the work that we did on all of them, and I'm really, each of them is kind of interesting and useful in a different way, I think. You know, the documentary is called Inside Disaster. It hasn't come out yet. It's still being edited. And what we got to do by creating, you know, this website, InsideDisaster.com, that you can go to now, we took all the themes, we took all the interesting kind of conflicts and stuff that came out of the material that the team brought back from Haiti, and we were able to take that and turn that into kind of interactive educational material. So that's like, that. I'm really proud of how we were able to do that, and I think it's going to be useful to have these quizzes, to have, you know, we have a whole section of the website that's called Survival, and it says, how did people survive after the quake, with or without humanitarian aid? So there'll be a section on water, and it'll show how people got water on their own, mm-hmm, and how people got water through the humanitarian aid agencies. So we really tried to show both sides of the stories, not just that it was only the humanitarians doing work down there, but it was also the Haitian people were figuring out how to survive on their own, and they did a hell of a job of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we really wanted to demonstrate that. And then with the simulation, you know, to get to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, to see what it's like to be a journalist down there, to be an aid worker, and most of all, to be a survivor, and actually make decisions from the point of view of those people and experience the consequences of it. That's something that I think is going to be a really useful tool for anyone who's, you know, thinking about getting into this world, either as a journalist or an aid worker or anything else. I think they'll get something out of trying that out for themselves and seeing some of the conflicts that can come up.
You know, what I do for a living is I'm not going to compare it to Hades or things of that nature, but, you know, mine's a small scale, mine's business and housings mm-hmm, and single dwellings. You know, what putting someone's life back together is, you know, for me at the end of the day, it's self-gratifying.
Exactly.
What is, but yours obviously on a larger scale, which is incredible. Because, you know, basically you live and breathe that type of thing. You're not in it for the money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so why don't we give the contacts again so people can check it out?
Sure, yeah. So the whole educational website is at insidedisaster.com, and it's a website for anyone who wants to learn about the Haiti earthquake, anyone who's interested in humanitarian work and wants to find out how they can get involved in that field. There's tons of information, tons of links, lots of video. And, you know, we're trying to make that the definitive resource for people who are interested in those two subjects. And then if people want to check out InsideTheHaitiEarthquake.com, and there's also links to it all over the other website. InsideTheHaitiEarthquake.com is the first-person interactive simulation that we've created. It's free. It's open to anyone to use. All you need is a high-speed web connection and, you know, Flash installed on your computer, which everybody has. And, yeah, it's a chance to just get inside the perspectives of either a survivor, a journalist, or an aid worker in the aftermath of the Haiti earthquake. And everything you see there is real footage. Everything you see there really happened. So it's the real deal.
Thanks. Katie, I can't thank you enough with Nico also coming on the show and giving us your experiences and how people can get educated about the whole situation. Because, you know, it's just not Haiti. It's going to be another country. It could happen in Canada. It can happen in the United States. And being prepared is the key. You know, that anxiety that wouldn't exist as much and it wouldn't have, you know, so-called chaos, if you will. Katie, again, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming on. Take care.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having us on and thanks for keeping the spotlight on Haiti.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Again, I just want to say thanks to Katie McKenna and Nicholas Gillette. You know, again, it's about Haiti in the last couple of weeks, but it could be pretty relative. It could be anywhere. But it's always about the show is about being prepared. And if you want to catch any of this, you can go to cppems.com. It's my website. There's the podcast. There's a bunch of other links that you can bunch onto, including Inside Disaster. And then there's also the other ones. There's also with the guys from the fire departments and the OEM guys and lots of guys in the disaster world that I interact with on a daily basis. So I think it was a great show, and she said thanks for keeping an eye on Haiti. Again, it could be really anywhere, and you can scale it down to your own neighborhood. This past March with the storms, you know, you had whole neighborhoods without power, and people really, you know, didn't have anything. So being prepared would be key. And also, if Katie and Nico can answer some questions, go to the comment page on my website, again at cppems.com. Throw out some questions for them, and I'll get a hold of them if they didn't pop in and check up, and get those comments and your questions answered. Again, this is Disaster Recovery Hour. I'm your host, Chris Plunkett. Enjoy the rest of the weekend, and let's end the war and bring home our troops. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Disaster Recovery Hour with your host, Chris Plunkett, from CPP Emergency Services and Restoration. You can reach Chris by calling 201-483-8953. And don't forget to tune in every Saturday morning at 7 for the Disaster Recovery Hour, right here on AM 970, The Apple.